Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
In 2016, 64,000 Americans died unnatural deaths in kitchens and living rooms, under freeway overpasses, and in alleys. The culprit, drug overdoses. And a major contributor to that lethal number was the abuse of opioids. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We hear a lot about the opioid crisis these days, but if you're fortunate enough not to have struggled with this addiction or cared about somebody who has, it may be hard to picture these people who get hooked on the class of drugs related to heroin. Time magazine set out to show us, with its first ever issue devoted entirely to the work of a single photographer, James Noctway. Paul Moakley is deputy director of photography and visual enterprise for Time, and he spent a year working at Noctway's side to document the opioid crisis in communities across America. That issue, published March 5th, is called The Opioid Diaries, and Paul Moakley joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about what it reveals and how it came together. Paul, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
How did you and your colleagues start talking about this idea, and how did you decide this was a story that could be best told in pictures?
Sure. I think, this is a problem and a story that we've been covering for quite some time. 3 years ago, we did a cover story about how people who were on prescription medication became addicted, and they were moving over to heroin, and there was a spike in HIV cases in a small town, and it was a big cover story that we did, and probably one of the last major stories that we did, even though we've covered it in little ways. But 2 years ago in October, there was an image that came across our desks. Our director of photography, Kira Pollack, and myself, there was an image from East Liverpool, Ohio, of a little boy in a car with his grandparents overdosed. And it was a picture that was just shocking. And it was taken by a police officer. And we didn't know at the time. It was just an image that was floating around Facebook. And we were asked if we would want to publish it. And we were just shocked by the image. And we said no off the bat. We just wanted to know more about it. And we wanted to find out kind of where this picture was coming from. And were his grandparents dead? And who were, we didn't really know anything about the picture. It was just shocking. But what we did discover was I ended up going to that town and working on a story about everything that happened behind that photograph. And we discovered that it was taken by a police officer, and the town and the mayor and everyone came to the conclusion that they needed to publish this image on Facebook because they were so frustrated by the crisis in their town and what they were seeing every day in terms of overdoses and how it was affecting families and children like the boy in the car. And we just kept on talking about the epidemic and trying to figure out, as visual people, we're photo directors and we work on video and multimedia projects. And we just thought, like, what could we do to tell this story and to make it more real for people if a picture like this from a police officer could be so powerful and go viral and have such a big response? What more could we do to tell this story? And that's when we really started to focus and really try to think about the issue that we have now with James Noctway.
What's so interesting is that I knew Noctway as a conflict photographer. So talk about what made his sensibility right for a project like this.
Sure. James has been one of the great contributors to Time magazine. He's worked for the magazine for over 32 years on contract, and he has primarily photographed some of the major conflicts of the last three decades. But James is really also focused on the aftermath of these situations, and that's mainly when you look back on his books like Inferno, you'll just see the devastation and people kind of within the midst of the aftermath of these situations, and he's looking at the struggles of life after these things and trying to find the humanity in them and the places where just people who are just kind of left behind in the aftershocks of these things. And he's just kind of the perfect communicator in a way of some of these situations. He really personalizes images, and I think that's what's really interesting about him is that when you look at his pictures, there are hardly any landscapes. It's mostly focused on individuals and their reactions, and they're very much taken within intimate spaces. And we've been trying to think of a story for him here in the United States for a very long time, and this just was something that evolved from a few conversations and really thinking about it. And Kira Pollack, our director of photography, really thought Jim would be perfect for this, and so did I. And we spent a lot of time producing this before we started.
The opioid crisis is happening all over the country, in big cities and suburbs and small towns and rural areas. How did you create a travel itinerary?
Sure. I think we spent a long time thinking about where should we be going. And we were looking at the demographics and the numbers around the country, which are really hard to track and have only, you know, I feel like people have only started to really keep numbers of overdoses within the last couple of years and tracking what was going on in the situation. And at the time, the numbers kind of led us to Dayton, Ohio. And I think the main reason for that was Dayton has a really interesting guy working for the Montgomery County Sheriff's Department named Bruce Langos, and he keeps track of all the numbers. He's a former tech billionaire and data analyst genius, and he's actually retired and started to help the deputy, the sheriff's department there. And they were seeing these incredibly high numbers, and they were doing weekly reports. And at the time, a lot of people noticed like Dayton became the epicenter of the epidemic because I think mainly because it was really bad there, and they were keeping almost real time numbers that we were seeing, where a lot of the information we get from the CDC is often a year or two old. But that was kind of one of the things that led us to Dayton. And then we started to look at numbers in other places. And, you know, there are just these places that we've been hearing about for a long time, like West Virginia and Massachusetts and New Hampshire and all these places in the former Rust Belt. But then there are also places on the West Coast that the western part of the United States that I don't think get as much attention because the situation has either been like endemic in a city like San Francisco, or the heroin situation in New Mexico is something that's, you know, hasn't really relented since the 90s and has been going on for a long time, but is still significant in terms of the story now. And the thing that we kind of also used as a guide was the story of fentanyl and how that this drug was showing up in the last couple of years. And this was really causing a spike in fatalities, and it kind of changed heroin and what we were seeing in terms of it just being this like incredibly dangerous drug out there. And
you mentioned demographics a few minutes ago, Paul. Most of the drug users depicted in this special issue are white. Was that a deliberate choice that reflects the percentage of Americans addicted to opioids?
I think, you know, statistically, there is a higher number of white users within this epidemic, but it's not to underestimate what is happening in other communities around the country. Like, for instance, in the Bronx, New York has a very, it's an epidemic that's really affecting the community there. But in some of the places we visited, I would definitely say in Boston and in San Francisco and in New Mexico, we were seeing a much more diverse demographic. And some of that is represented in the issue through the foster family and through through some other things on the website. But we were primarily in Ohio and in West Virginia and New Hampshire, we were seeing a white community being affected. But it is interesting, and I think that just recently the demographics of this epidemic have been being looked at in comparison with the crack epidemic, which is really interesting to think about those two things in the continuum of these epidemics. I don't think like one stops and one starts immediately. There is a weird continuum that you could connect through all these things.
Once you arrived in each place, how did you go about finding people who were addicted?
Sure. I think it would happen through different, you know, we were trying to see it through different perspectives. And in the beginning, we started with a very long ride along with the Montgomery County Sheriff's Department in Ohio, who were really incredible. They were very frustrated at the time. And the sheriff, Phil Plummer, really wanted to show the world what was happening there. And he was inviting almost every news organization. And I have to say, I called them very early on and scheduled something months in advance. And then that week we were traveling there, I believe Dateline did a big show about them, and they started to get a ton of media attention. And the New York Times wrote about them as the epicenter. And then, you know, everyone continued to kind of go in there and dig, I think, after we left. And it was interesting to see, because we were holding onto this material for a long time, but, you know, it was interesting to see kind of everyone's take on what was happening there. So we definitely went through first responders. And then within each place, we tried to go through different people. We tried to go through families. We spent a lot of time in New Hampshire trying to find a family that was going through a funeral of losing what it's like to lose a loved one who recently overdosed or died in a drug-related incident. And, you know, we connected with a family that was going through, you know, one of the most devastating moments of their life, this incredible mom, Justine, lost her daughter, Michaela, and she invited us to the funeral, and James attended, and then afterwards we spent a lot of time with the family, hearing their story and reporting with them, and we went to places, you know, where opioid-exposed babies were being taken care of in West Virginia. We went to different hospitals in Lawrence, Massachusetts. We worked with harm reduction specialists in Boston and San Francisco. And it was just always finding our way through different people, through families, through people who were using drugs. And the thing that we tried to do was just take it really slow. We'd go to a place for a few weeks at a time and get to know people. I think one thing I just would really love for people to know, and it's hard to communicate when you're looking at the issue because James's pictures feel so immediate, but we spent a lot of time with people. It was often multiple days or weeks. And when in a lot of these very dramatic situations, we went back to them and we got to know the people and spent a lot of time reporting over the last 10 months.
You know, you spend time with people, you get to know them, you can't help but care about them. It has to be strange to now have this large collection of people that you're worried about.
It is. It's definitely something that weighs on you, but it's also something that has really inspired us to push forward with this issue and want to be out here promoting it and take it to Washington. We just last weekend we went to Washington and presented the work, and Senator Hassan joined us for a talk after. And the next day we were so surprised and happy to see her bring it up at in the Senate, and it was submitted as evidence, and we're really proud of that the issue is being seen by people who are affecting law. But when it comes to the families, there's an incredible amount of responsibility you feel of telling their story in a way that is correct, and also, like, just there were so many people that felt helpless, I would say, whether they were drug users or families that lost someone or were struggling with addiction in their families, or whether it was first responders who were dealing with a lot of PTSD. It was like we definitely became very involved in their stories and trying to voice what they were really giving to us.
Paul Moakley is Deputy Director of Photography and Visual Enterprise for Time Magazine. The special issue released March 5th is called The Opioid Diaries. It's devoted to the work of photographer James Nachtwey, who spent a year, along with Moakley, documenting the crisis of opioid addiction and overdose across the United States. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Paul Moakley, who's Deputy Director of Photography and Visual Enterprise for Time Magazine. Time's March 5th issue is called The Opioid Diaries. It's devoted to work by photographer James Noctway, who spent a year documenting the crisis of opioid addiction and overdose across the U.S. Paul Moakley was at his side the entire year. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Paul, how do people end up addicted to opioids?
I would say it happens in a variety of ways. There, you know, since the beginning of time, people have been trying to make themselves feel better through all different kinds of, right. of drugs and, you know, substances. But I would say within this past year and going, seeing the country through this lens and visiting all these places, I would say almost 90 or over 90% of the conversations that I had with people, so many of them started with prescription drugs and started in the same way. I was in a car accident and I was prescribed drugs. I was, you know, a football player in high school and I was prescribed opioids. It's a story and a narrative that was repeated over and over again in hundreds of interviews that I conducted.
Why does addiction set in so quickly?
I don't know. It's something that I questioned a lot along the way. I do think that it happens in a number of different ways. Again, I think that this is like something that is so vast that I think it's really hard to generalize anything. And that was a big part of what we were trying to do with the pictures and the voices was just make it as individual as possible. But I think that some people are just more susceptible in some ways to it. And I think that with prescriptions, with that layer, I think people were more trusting of what they were getting into. And I think that's something that really makes this story very unique.
Yeah. And of course, people may know by this point that when this class of drugs, the pill version that's sold by pharmaceutical companies, was first introduced, prescribing doctors were told by Big Pharma, by the way, these have a particularly low rate of dependency.
Yes. I remember when I've been working on health stories for most of my career, been a photo editor for almost 23 years. And I remember being at Newsweek as a young photo editor and doing these stories about pain and cover stories about how you should not experience pain and all the options that are out there for you. And we were so anti-pain that it was this enormous campaign that helped propel a lot of these drugs and create a lot of the thinking around and our feelings in regards to these substances.
Somebody described his addiction to you as being like a relationship to somebody you love. And I think for anyone who hasn't experienced addiction, that's a really evocative way of explaining it.
Yes. It was something also that was like a narrative that came up multiple times through a few different people. And, you know, I have to say, everyone we spoke to, you always learned something incredibly unique from each person. But there was a little bit of that narrative came through, or somebody described it. One thing that really stood out was this man, John, in Boston, and he described it as a warm hug from Jesus. And it was you know, this feeling of comfort and wanting to be comfortable and forget about things. And that was another theme that kind of emerged through all these stories.
The other thing that I think I really got from this series was the idea that these are not people who are deluded. They know it's a problem. They know they should stop. They can't stop. They can't imagine their life without the drug. But they're under no illusions that things are going fine for them.
Completely. I would say that almost all the people we spoke to were very reflective and self-aware. And that was another thing also. I think when you're out there and you're immersing yourself in particular communities and situations, you do find people that do want to open up to you. And but the awareness of what they were controlled by was really interesting. And, you know, and you just heard this repeated, you know, I don't want to be in this situation, but I have absolutely no control. And I think the extreme cases where you see that is like a pregnant mother or somebody who just has full sense of of, you know, their body and what they're doing, and they just do not want to be in this situation. But the drug is so powerful that they it just gave me a very different understanding of this idea of like having no choice.
Please continue. I'm sorry.
No. It was just, I think, like the it really hit me with all the mothers that we met that were kind of in these situations, not even the pregnant ones, some who really fell into hard addiction, lost their families, ended up on the street, and worked really hard to get their families back.
Well, I have to say, getting ready to talk to you, I looked through the issue multiple times. There are extraordinary photographs throughout. The one that I think I might never forget is of this pregnant woman who lost custody of the child she delivered because she was addicted. In the photo, she's 6 months pregnant and she's 35 years old, but she looks, I mean, she looks at least 60 in that picture.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was a subject, a woman named Rachel, and we met her in Dayton multiple times over the summer. She was one of the first people we met in the neighborhood, and I think everyone around was just shocked and devastated by what she was going through. And, you know, we first saw her with the police, well with our sheriff's deputies. And then we got to know her a little bit. And it was just heartbreaking to watch. And, you know, there was a moment where she was just in such bad shape that she was very hard to have conversations with. And she's very ethereal just in general. But I ended up meeting a childhood friend of hers who, you know, would take care of their family and Rachel and started to tell me the story of her mother and her family and where she's coming from. And it was one of those moments where I just, you know, hoped in some way that some of the text or some of the narrative that we're using describes the complexity of what you're seeing, because that is a shocking image to see. And she's standing there on the street and she's in a shirt that says love, which is so, I find so heartbreaking. But one of the things I have to say is when I first saw that image come back from gym, I was shocked by it. And I actually opened up my video of that moment because I was recording video alongside Jim most of the time. And a lot of those videos ended up in different stories on the website. But I had to look at the video to see what she looked like in that moment. Mm. And she looked that way. She was in such bad shape. It was the summer. And we went on one trip and we went back and returned. And she was still in very bad shape. But as I was on the airplane, she actually delivered the baby as I was on the way there. And when I got off the plane, I heard that she had her child, and she actually left the hospital the same night to go get high. And you know, if like it's just, again, shows you kind of the state of control that the drug takes over and puts upon you. But I saw her, and I actually sat down with her at a bus stop, and I was having this long conversation with her about where she was, and she was just crying and devastated about everything that was happening, and she, you know, was telling everyone that she wasn't doing drugs, but then she you know, pulled me aside, and she wanted to show me where she was injecting, and it was just a heartbreaking kind of moment, and as we continued to work on this months later, I really felt like we needed to go back, and I personally really wanted to go back and see how she was doing. And just serendipitously, I was in Ohio, I was getting gas, I went back to the neighborhood, and she just walked down the street. It was like, we just found each other again, and she looked like a different person. Hmm. And she told me, you know, I'm trying to find out for sure how she's doing, but she told me that she's in recovery for the last 2 months. She looked incredible. When we did our talk last week, James actually showed a more recent picture of her. But she said she's doing well, and she's trying. She wants to have this kid back because she lost two boys in the past, and she doesn't want the same thing to happen with this more recent child. And she's working hard to try to get her kid back. And you know, and I just hope the best for her. But it's It is so tenuous, and you just don't know where people are going to go. But she's somebody that I'm definitely hoping to keep in touch with, and I hope the best for.
So I really don't want to stigmatize just to be mean, but one of the hallmarks of addiction is that people who have addiction lie, right, about their use and about, mm-hmm. about a lot of
it's
different
something
things.
Yes.
Yeah. So as a journalist, how do you manage that as you're collecting these stories?
I think that, you know, as for every subject, I tried to get as many different perspectives as possible, whether it was, you know, being on the street in Boston and meeting someone and then asking if I could go meet their parents or going to meet a counselor. And, you know, when it comes to the medical profession, you know, we have all these like these laws that protect our privacy and the HIPAA laws. And so it becomes very complicated in terms of getting permission. But there were times where we did get that permission and we were able to really dig into someone's life and go back into their family and friends and get other voices on them or the people who take care of them. Oftentimes there are people who are homeless on the street that, you know, they are just like us. You know, these are all people who had lives in different, you know, capacities and do have lives currently. They just happen to not have homes or jobs and they're really struggling. And, you know, oftentimes they do have people that are out there taking care of them, coming to bring them food and clothes. It's just and oftentimes those people would help us in sort of trying to figure out their paths and keeping tabs on where they're going.
It must have been hard, you know, certain times when you called up parents or siblings or people who cared about these individuals who are now on the street. How often were they asking you, well, how is this person doing and how did they look to you?
That's something I think that these parents or, you know, or loved ones are really hungry for. They want, you know, some perspective. I think they spend, from the conversations that I had, there's, you know, and even in my own family where people are dealing with these issues, you know, you spend so much time worrying, and it was something I could really relate to. But these parents were just, they wanted to just know that their kids were safe or that they were trying. And so they would ask you a lot of questions and you would feel that. But I think, you know, there were also parents that just had these, you know, incredible perspectives on how they get through their day knowing that their kid is addicted to drugs, living on the street, and how do you, you know, it's hard enough as a parent to go to sleep at night not worrying about your kids and what they're up to. But when you know your kid is in this situation, you know, how do you do that? And I met this extraordinary mother who is, we have an interview with her in the magazine named Christina Barboza, and she gave us this incredibly powerful interview just about hope and knowing that as long as her son is breathing, it gives her hope that there's another chance to try to get recovery or for him to turn around. And it's something that she struggles with and lives with every day. But she was, I think the thing that struck me about her was her openness. And I think that's something we're seeing with a lot of parents who are coming out about their kids' addiction and lifting the stigma around this, or whether even if in cases where people have overdosed, you're seeing it more and more in obituaries and parents trying to put it out there so people, their friends turn around and get help and support.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Paul Moakley, Deputy Director of Photography and Visual Enterprise for Time Magazine. Its March 5th issue is called The Opioid Diaries. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk a little bit about a theme through this, and you've already alluded to it, is first response workers and the trauma that they have experienced seeing so many people having overdosed, many of whom have died. I mean, it sounds like they're seeing more deaths to overdose than they see from street violence, which is what we associate with the kind of trauma that police officers and paramedics deal with.
Yes, I would say that is one of the, you know, the hardest things that, you know, that they're dealing with these days is the amount of overdose calls that they're going to. It's kind of unbelievable in certain places. In Dayton, Ohio, when we were there, they would have an average, this was over the summer, they would have an average of, you know, 16 to you know, or more overdose calls a day, with 1 to 3 being fatal. So no matter what, you knew when you were going into work that day that somebody was going to be dead from a drug overdose. And I just, one of the days where it just really hit me was, you know, we were there on 4th of July and we would start the day, you know, kind of in, not that early, around 11, and there were already three fatalities. You know, you'd come to work in the morning, and that's when most people are waking up, and they're discovering that their loved ones are have overdosed and overnight. And so you would arrive at a lot of these scenes that just where people passed away overnight and were found in the morning, and so the police officers are just showing up to these over and over again, and I think it's taken an incredible toll on them. It's something that I don't think that older cops trained for. When they were starting, and the younger cops, it's just part of the job for them. There were very different perspectives between the generations. In Dayton, there was a really great sense of alignment among the whole department, where they were all using naloxone and Narcan to revive people, and they really felt like it was their duty to just save lives. And so there was this really, I think it really imbued them with a sense that they were doing something to try to help. And I think that was helping them. It wasn't something that they were struggling with as a department, where there were other places in the state where Narcan was more controversial. And the idea of spending money to revive people was controversial when you are there to save people's lives. And they felt very strongly about that. And I think that really helped them. Kind of just as an idea, I think it really did. But in other places around the country, you know, we were just seeing, I remember meeting a first responder, and it's something that was said to me off the record, but, you know, it was a first responder who was struggling very badly, and it actually led them to be using substances to cope with what they were seeing every day. And that was heartbreaking to listen to. And so scary.
My guest is Paul Moakley. He's Deputy Director of Photography and Visual Enterprise for Time Magazine. Time's March 5th issue is called The Opioid Diaries. It's devoted to work by photographer James Notway, who spent a year along with Moakley documenting the crisis of opioid addiction and overdose. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or go to Twitter. We're at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is Deputy Director of Photography and Visual Enterprise for Time Magazine. Paul Moakley traveled with photographer James Notway, and they spent a year documenting the opioid crisis around the country. We were talking a minute ago about police officers and paramedics carrying naloxone or Narcan with them to reverse an otherwise fatal overdose. You found high school nurses are stocking this stuff, too.
Yes. One of the most surprising stories that I felt like I heard along the way was actually from a funeral director named Buddy Fanuff from New Hampshire, where he was talking about how the funeral home is stocked up on Narcan, because oftentimes when these funerals happen with a young person who, you know, was using drugs and died of an overdose, their friends will come and oftentimes overdose at the viewing. And they need to have it there, you know, inside the funeral home. You see librarians being trained in, you know, all over the country, in Philadelphia and Cincinnati. It's just everywhere in the most surprising places. But I think it's also something, you know, Narcan and naloxone, it should be out there. It's something that is something that could easily save someone's life. And it does mean the difference between life and death. And so it is, you know, I think the more it's out there, the better that is.
All right, let's go to the did you have more to say? I'm sorry.
No, there are incredible people out there who really are just helping to get it out there. And I think, like, the more you can empower people to save lives, the better. And that's, like, you know, one of the major lessons we learned from working with harm reduction people out there.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Pedro on the line in Dallas. Hi, Pedro.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, Paul, thank you so much for everything that you're doing for awareness of the opioid crisis in America. Could you comment on any experience that you have with doctors that are actually creating an opioid-free environment for their patients regarding acute or chronic pain management?
Yeah, there are, you know, I think pain management is definitely something that, you know, needs to be rethought in, you know, in our country. And I wasn't able to dig deeply into that aspect of it entirely with this story, but there are some incredible doctors in San Francisco that are doing these very holistic therapies with acupuncture and yoga, and doing that with you know, the homeless population out there, and trying to get people off of drugs. But I think that, you know, one of the things is, we do need to rethink the amount of medication we take and maybe not take as much, but we also need to think about alternative therapies and ways of dealing with pain. And I think that's definitely a big conversation that we still need to have and go forward with.
Did you have a chance to talk to any people who are dealing this stuff?
A little bit. There were definitely very young, low-level drug dealers on the street that were approaching me and asking us what we were doing. People, you know, we're always curious about. Jim and I, we were there. We're very open about what we're doing. We both have cameras slinged around our necks, and I have a tape recorder. So we really do stick out. But not very deep conversations, but it was sad to see, like, very young population of people, like, really out there working on the street, selling these drugs and just thinking about, like, the dangerous situation they're also putting themselves in out there, and also that they're hurting people out there at such a young age. It's just mind-boggling to me in some ways.
Does opioid addiction respond to rehab at about the same success rate as addiction to other substances?
What I've learned, I'm definitely not a medical expert or a doctor, but from going to rehabilitation facilities, I've actually learned that that some substances like alcohol are actually a lot harder to detox from. If you have long-term chronic alcohol use, getting off of opioids is definitely incredibly hard and challenging. And I think that the thing that we've learned out there from this experience was that a lot of people are having great success with medically assisted treatment, or what people are calling MATS, using methadone, Suboxone, and other kinds of treatments, along with going to meetings. I think one of the things that I find strange about the whole thing is that there is really no silver bullet solution. I think we went to other 12-step program living facilities where it's entirely sober and there is no medically assisted treatment. And there is a percentage of people doing well there. But by and far, I think, like, the success rate for people on MATS is 85%. And it's lower for 12-step programs where they don't offer any assistance. So it's definitely, there are numbers and statistics that I think are definitely worth looking at. I think that we need to look at these further, I think, as the years go on, and we're kind of learning along the way, and it's fascinating. But I think combined with that, I think that one of the things that's very clear to me is we need to support people through longer treatment stays in whatever rehabilitation they're in. I think 40 days or 30 days doesn't really work. 6 months works a lot better, or even a year for some people who really need it. I think the longer we could support people, the better the success rate in the long run. And that was something that was very clear to me after looking at this for the last 2 years.
Many people who have an opioid addiction end up doing time in the criminal justice system because their habits are illegal. Is there any evidence that jail time is effective as a detox? And are there jurisdictions that are trying to use jail as more than just a holding place?
Yes, I would say one of the most interesting programs we saw was in Covington, the correctional facility in Covington, Kentucky, called the Kenton County Correctional Center. And there's an incredible program run there by a formerly homeless drug user named Jason Merrick, who created a therapeutic community within the detention center. And they just figured, since these guys are there, why not have a voluntary program where people can recover and go through a 12-step like program and focus on their recovery and use that time to help themselves. And they currently are taking care of around 100 to 120 inmates at a time going through this program. And we visited that, actually. I visited it twice and made a short documentary about Jason. But it's a great program and something that I think he is working on getting replicated. He goes to a lot of prisons to speak about this. There were a lot of places that were, you know, kind of sad. We went to a jail in Ohio at one point. And when I was there, I asked, I was like, so what do you do with them? What are their treatment programs to the jailer? And he was like, oh, actually, we don't have anything. They just kind of detox and, you know, on their own. And they kind of suffer through it and go through it. But they don't have any programs like 12-step or meetings or anything. And then we went back a couple of weeks later and I was at a town meeting and they were like, we just want you to know, we just started the Suboxone program in the jail. Hmm. And so I think in some cases it's like just connecting the dots. I think people aren't thinking about all these things and it's really hard. I think as a community we need to connect the people who are doing these like great things and oftentimes people just aren't aware of what they could be doing because in most cases we found that people did want to help and try to do something.
Sometimes I struggle to understand why Suboxone and methadone are so stigmatized. I get mm-hmm. that being addicted to a substance that changes your cognition is a real problem and it can be deadly. I don't really understand why a maintenance medication that keeps those effects from happening and sort of keeps you on the straight and narrow is so abhorrent to people.
I know. I think it's you know, in America, we often have, like, we have a very conservative point of view. I would say that the mass general population has a very conservative view on drug use. And in terms of methadone and Suboxone, it's like you are giving somebody, they're not buying drugs off the street. They're being prescribed a drug that is safe. They're being able to take it in a safe environment. And the idea is to hopefully, you know, get to a point where you can function better and have a higher quality of life. And who are we to determine what that is? It's there are people who, for a variety of reasons, whether it's mental or physical, need to be on medication throughout their lives. So you know, I do think, like, talking about it more and lifting the stigma is one of the ways that we can help with the approach to a medically assisted treatment program for people. But it is interesting to see the stigma around it. I would say that people are coming around in surprising places. Like, you know, in some places, like this kind of work, you know, that has been happening for a while is just, it's a lot newer in some places. And I feel like when we're in West Virginia, the idea of harm reduction was new, but it was exciting to some people, and it was also very controversial with other people. But these are things that have worked for a very long time in cities and have proven track records.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm talking this hour with Time Magazine's Paul Moakley about the opioid crisis in America. Time has a special issue released March 5th called The Opioid Diaries. Did you learn a lot, Paul, about how other sort of Western democracies are dealing with opioid addiction?
A little bit. You know, we definitely were looking at Vancouver and the safe injection facilities. And, you know, in the United States, we have three cities that have voted for these, and yet none of them have been implemented yet. We have Philadelphia, Seattle, and San Francisco have all, you know, cities have voted that it would be, this is something that we want and should do to keep people safer. you know, I think when I think of James's pictures in this issue, and I think of this young girl, there's a picture of a young girl under a truck in the snow, and it was one of the hardest situations I feel like we were in the whole time of working on this issue. Mm-hmm. But what you're seeing in that picture is just somebody pushed to the absolute fringes. And, you know, it just, in that moment, being out there with harm reduction specialists, there's an incredible place called A-Hope in Boston that really helps a lot of the population out in the street there and supplies them with not only with clean needles, but it's a place where they can get drug tested and find out if they have hepatitis or HIV. And it's a place that keeps people healthier. It provides them with food. It's, you know, everything from condoms to, you know, just it's just a place that's keeping people healthy. And what happens when we just like are a little bit nicer to people and just give them an opportunity to maybe turn around and ask for help? Will they get off of these? The drugs that are harming them, will they do things that are less unsafe? I think that is, you know, something that is a great lesson to be learned from harm reduction specialists who've been doing this work since the 80s, you know, in you know, with HIV and, you know, when we were going through an AIDS crisis. I think there's so much to be learned from that, that statistically the numbers are there that harm reduction does kind of work. And it, that was something that we really got into and really learned and began to understand and something that I hope we actually do more work on, because I think there's so much stigma around that kind of work, and no one wants a needle exchange in their neighborhood. No one wants the drug users in their neighborhood. So it's very hard to help them. It's like a weird, a very weird place we're in that, you know, it's like you want to help these people, but you don't want to be near them.
How did you and James process your emotions in reporting this story?
I think, you know, I can't speak for James, but I think, you know, being with him was really interesting and really good for me in some ways as a journalist. It's something that, you know, he was like a guiding force for me in a lot of ways because he's been through so much. And when I was very young, aspiring photo editor, photographer, I always remember being at a talk and that Jim was giving. And somebody said, how do you not go crazy after seeing all these things and being in all these situations? And James just simply replied that you always have to know why you're there. And that's something that I always keep in my head with whatever story I'm working on, whether I'm working on a photo shoot in Washington or I'm working on this story. You always have to know why you're there and where your heart is, and that's something that, you know, I feel like that we just do to make sure that we're doing these stories in the way that we feel are as good as possible.
Paul Moakley is Deputy Director of Photography and Visual Enterprise for Time Magazine. The issue released March 5th, called The Opioid Diaries, is devoted to work by photographer James Noctway. Paul Moakley traveled with Noctway across the United States to document the opioid addiction crisis for a year. Paul, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for talking about this issue.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can find the podcast on any podcast app, and you can also get archives of the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.